Brazil's Foreign Affairs Ministry recently authorized the installation of a plaque at the Brazilian embassy in Santiago, the Chilean capital, to honor militants who were tortured and killed by the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. The plaque will also bear words in defense of democracy, critically recognizing the participation of agents of Brazilian repression in the crimes committed. It is well known that the U.S. played a role in defeating Salvador Allende in the 1964 elections, financing the opposition, and that when he won in 1970, it backed anti-Allende protests, such as the trucker strike after Allende tried to nationalize their industry. Recently declassified documents even show that President Richard Nixon was briefed on the planned military takeover in 1973. But what role did Brazil play in Allende's downfall? That is what we will explain this week. My name is Gustavo Ribeiro, editor-in-chief of the Brazilian Report. This is Explaining Brazil. If you like Explaining Brazil, you should subscribe to the Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this podcast. We are an independent organization funded by our subscribers, and you can help us stay independent and continue to produce award-winning journalism. If you are already a subscriber, you can go the extra mile and join our Buy Me a Coffee fan page. In return, you get exclusive perks like special newsletters and behind-the-scenes content, as well as a shout-out here on our podcast. Today, I'd like to thank our Buy Me a Coffee members, Andrei Novozeltsev, Tom Nolan, Marta Martins, Ben Ludwig, Leslie Seal, Caroline Hilbert, Mark Hillary, John Thomas III, Luis Hans, Aaron Menais, Orlando Black, Steve Knapp, Aaron Berger, James Coney, Kars Vresvik, Alasdair Townsend, Peter Abrahamson, Jim Awofadeju, Michael Fryer, Miller Renascido, David Dixon, José José Stankovic, Emerging Market Muser, Jordan Iftach, Tunica Thompson, Anderson da Silva, Kat Kramer, Peter Suffering, Anna Lund, and someone who chose to remain anonymous. And if you too believe in the importance of independent journalism, and if you want to hear your name on our podcast, go to buymeacoffee.com/Brazilian Report and subscribe to one of the membership tiers. Click on buymeacoffee.com/Brazilian Report to find out more. Roberto Simon is a Brazilian journalist based in New York City. In 2021, he published in Brazil the book Brazil Against Democracy, The Dictatorship, The Coup in Chile, and the Cold War in South America. Simon explains how the Brazilian dictatorship, which had seized power in 1964, played an important role in helping Chilean conspirators usher General Augusto Pinochet into power. Roberto, thanks for joining us this week. Before we get into the core subject of your book, which has just gotten a Spanish edition, I wanted you to remind us what the political context was like leading up to 1973.
In many ways, Chile is in the 1970s becomes a unique experiment, right? The first time in history when a truly socialist, revolutionary president comes to power by democratic means. And when I say socialist, Allende was different from, for example, social democrats in Europe, in the sense that he was not trying to implement marginal reforms or enlarge a welfare state or things like that. He was actually trying to build a truly socialist economy in Chile by changing the means of production from the private sector to the state, pass in an accelerated pace, major changes in terms of land ownership, and what you would imagine, right, when it comes to transitioning from a capitalist economy to a socialist economy. And this was taking place, of course, in a very, you know, in a country in South America, through a coalition between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, the Unidad Popular, the Popular Unity, that won the elections in 1970, and won with a very thin margin, right? Something like 37% of the votes. And at the time, Chile didn't have runoffs, so Congress confirmed Allende, but Allende didn't have control over Congress, and he had a very energized base and support by from massive social movements in Chile, but he also faced very strong opposition. And of course, we have the emergence of a socialist leader in the middle of the Cold War, right, in South America. So countries like the United States, then under the Nixon administration, but also Brazil under President Medici, immediately start seeing Allende as a threat, right, in that Cold War logic of West versus East or capitalist versus socialist.
And once Allende ascends to power, what happens then? How does he conduct his business?
Yeah, and I think the Allende presidency was both truly socialist and democratic, right? So in terms of socialism, he, from the outset, he starts implementing these very aggressive reforms to change the economy. So nationalizations, expropriating businesses. And this was done leveraging legislation that already existed in Chile, right? As discussed, he didn't have a strong majority in Congress. But in terms of land reform, he used what the Frei administration, his predecessor, had passed to drastically accelerate the pace of land reform. The same is true for the nationalization of all copper production in Chile. It was a process that began under the Frei administration. Frei was from the Christian Democrats, something like center left. But Allende was the one who really decided to nationalize and expropriate foreign companies that were producing mining copper in Chile. Right. So all of a sudden, you have this huge economic shock in terms of economic policy with expropriation of businesses, a drastic expansion of public expenditure to empower lower classes in Chile. And this is done through one main artifice, which is printing money. So all of a sudden, you start having very significant inflation in Chile. And as a complicating factor, you also had Allende's enemies in the private and public sector, but mostly in the private sector, waging what was called at the time an economic war on Allende. So when you look at the Allende presidency, he was elected in 1970, late 1970. 71, the economy starts growing really fast. Purchasing power, particularly for poorer Chileans, goes up. The output of industries, that's everything. The economy starts responding in a positive way really fast. But when you get to 1972, it's clear now that the economy has overheated. At the same time, social tensions and political tensions are very high and things start getting out of control, right? And not by coincidence, this is really when the country starts moving towards, a civil conflagration between the left and the right, right? That was, again, aggravated by the interference of foreign powers, including the United States.
Now, eventually, the economy slowed to a standstill and then lost ground. Economy Paul Rosenstein Rodin once wrote that Allende's downfall was caused by poor leadership, poor planning, and a lack of economic realism. Do you think this is a fair assessment at all?
Well, I think to blame Allende for the coup is just insane, right? In the sense that, yes, he implemented some disastrous policies, right, when he was in power. But at the same time, you had a massive and well-oiled machine built by very extreme forces in Chile, not only to overthrow Allende, but ultimately to shut down democracy, right? And this very powerful machinery was supported, as I was saying, by the United States, but also, as we know now, by Brazil, Brazilian military regime, and others, right? So Allende, as I was saying, he never violated the Constitution. He didn't have a control over Congress. He didn't have control over the Supreme Court, right? Which, and both institutions pushed back against his reforms repeatedly, right? And now we know also that just before the coup, Allende was actually preparing to call a plebiscite on his term, the plebiscite that if he were to lose, he would leave power democratically, right? So, you know, one has to bear in mind that 1973 Chile, or Chile in the early 1970s, was the you know, the strongest democracy in South America. If you compare Chile to Argentina, to Uruguay, to Brazil, you didn't have that history of military intervening repeatedly in politics, right? You had in Chile something like 130 years of civilian control over government with very minimal interference from the military, right? So that's one of the reasons, I think, why you know, it took some time for the military in Chile to get involved and decide to overthrow Allende, right? It's interesting. And when you see what was being published in Brazilian media at the time, for instance, everyone, the main newspapers published articles saying, you know, why doesn't Chile just repeat what we did in 1964, right? With the generals intervening and stopping Allende. And actually Brazil would work towards that end repeatedly, but it took them some time to convince and for the military officers in Chile, or most of them, to understand or to think that it would be a good idea, a wise idea, to violate the Constitution and overthrow a democratically elected government. But going back to your question, to say that Allende fell because the policies that he implemented were not sound, I think it's just if you say that, you disregard an absolutely critical part of the story, which is a commitment by certain forces within Chile and outside of Chile to overthrow democracy, and a commitment that started really shortly after Allende came to power in 1970.
Parties or institutions supported the coup internally in Chile. Because, I mean, the Christian Democrats who supported Allende in 1970 went on to support the coup in 1973.
Yeah, they were divided, right? And the Christian Democrats, much like Brazilian forces that you know, in the business sector, but also Brazilian politicians who supported the coup in 64, the Christian Democrats thought that the military would just intervene, overthrow Allende, and then they would be the next in power, right? Which is a story familiar with UDN in Brazil and others, right? And it never goes that way, right? Because once they get a taste for power, right, the military, they stay in power. In the case of Chile, they stayed in power until 1990, right? But, you know, when you look at the coalition that managed to overthrow Allende, it's a very diverse coalition that included sectors within the armed forces. The first, the conspiracy, so to speak, began in the Chilean Navy, then expanded to the Chilean Air Force, and the Army was the last major force to join the coup planning, right? But it was also essential for the coup to have the support of civil society. All the major business groups, right, the business organizations, the gremios, participated in the quote-unquote economic war against the Unidad Popular by organizing major strikes, by stockpiling goods, right, and contributing to scarcity across the country, by financing radical groups such as Patria y Libertad, was really a neo-fascist group, committing terrorist attacks across Chile. You also had the press, a very active press, making an opposition, because you had press in favor of Allende, but also major newspapers such as El Mercurio, at the time the largest newspaper in Chile, make a very strong opposition to Allende. And now we know that Mercurio was largely financed by the CIA, right? It was part of a massive operation in terms of the war for hearts and minds in Chile, right? So you have this very broad coalition putting in place a very sophisticated, I would say, plan to overthrow Chile. At the same time, Allende had strong allies, including the leftist media, workers' union, socialists, communists, campesinos, etc. So Chile was at one point on the brink of civil war, right? But instead of responding through democracy, as Allende himself was proposing, Allende never tried to impose censorship, for instance, on newspapers that were calling for his overthrow. But instead of answering this, political and civil conflagration through democracy, in the end, the response was the coup d'etat.
Also, you mentioned in your book that the Brazilian military dictatorship was an inspiration for Chilean conspirators. In which ways specifically?
Yeah, I think there are two parts to your question, right? The first, in terms of Brazil's soft power of making Chileans want what Brazil represented in the early 1970s. It's interesting when you look at Brazilian classified documents from the Brazilian repression, CIA documents, or what the members of the Pinochet junta were telling, the Brazilian ambassador, everyone was referencing a quote-unquote Brazilian model, right? Saying that Chile would follow the Brazilian model, right? And by that, what they were saying was that Chile was going to, be under a military regime, an anti-communist military regime, that would, by all necessary means, neutralize, quote unquote, the threat posed by the left, right? And to put the house in order to promote economic progress, right? And if you think about it, in 1970 to 1973, Brazil was the China of that time, the country that was growing the fastest. Now China it's not the country that grows faster here in our times, but Brazil was growing at double digits, right? It was the economic miracle of the Medici years. If you go back to 1970, when Allende wins and you start having this critical mobilization of conservative sectors within Chile, they're looking around, and Brazil is a natural example, right? As kind of one of the big defenders of the free world, right, in the Cold War context in South America, right? So I would say that an alliance was almost something natural, right? And Brazil and what Brazil had done against João Goulart in 1974 becomes an example, right, for the Chileans. And again, immediately after Allende's election, you have articles in Brazil saying that the Chileans should do what the Brazilians had done in 1964. So this is the side of, soft power, the Brazilian model, and how Brazil influenced the course of events in Chile in ways that other countries like the United States couldn't do it, right? Brazil was an example to those that were conspiring against Allende. But at the same time, Brazil provided Brazil intervened directly and took actions, right? It was not only a set of ideas, but took actions to actively undermine democracy in Chile, overthrow Allende, and help build the Pinochet regime, right? So from the outset, Brazil established connections with militaries that were, starting to discuss a quote-unquote extra-constitutional solution to the Chilean problem, right? That we're looking at Allende and saying, yes, at some point the military will have to intervene. Brazil really quickly established a direct channels with these agents, right? At the same time, Brazil started preparing for a civil war in Chile, one in which the Brazilian regime would support the right fighting against the left, right? At the same time, Brazil coordinated a diplomatic campaign to isolate Chile and to try to convince other countries in Latin America that Chile had become this incredible threat to the region, right? A country that would be kind of the new Cuba of Latin America, a magnet for guerrillas from across the region, right? So a destabilizing factor for the region. Brazil supported, as mentioned before, radical right-wing groups, neo-fascist groups that were involved in political violence in Chile, most notably Patria Libertad. Part of the leadership of Patria Libertad is actually in Brazil at the moment of the coup, had very strong connections to SNE, the National Information Service that was built in 1964 in Brazil. So when the coup happened, Brazil is already deeply involved. The intervention in the Brazilian intervention, so to speak, in Chile is taking place. And when the coup happens, Brazil is the first country to recognize the Pinochet regime. Actually, the Brazilian ambassador visited the members of the new junta the day of the coup, which was a tacit recognition of the new regime. And the official recognition came one or two days after that. And it was deliberate in the sense that Brazil wanted to recognize Pinochet really quickly to push other countries to do the same, other countries in Latin America, in Europe, and elsewhere. Brazil is also the first country to offer economic aid to Chile. Chile was practically bankrupt at that point. Brazil offers new lines of credits from public banks in Brazil, right? And also Brazil helps Chile renegotiate its debt with private banks and assists Chile at an IMF summit and becomes an advocate for Chile, not only when it came to economic matters, but also here in New York at the UN and bilaterally trying to convince countries like the UK or Germany that isolating Pinochet was not a good idea, despite all the news about human rights violations, torture, execution, etc., etc. And Brazil also becomes the second largest supplier of weapons to Pinochet. Right at the time when the U.S. Congress was trying to impose restrictions on the sale of weapons to Chile, other countries like the U.K. Were reluctant in sending weapons to Chile. Brazil had an incipient arms industry and sees what's going on in Chile not only as politically the right thing to do, but also as a lucrative opportunity. Right, for Brazilian industry and they seize the opportunity, and Chile under Pinochet becomes a huge market for the Brazilian arms industry. And I could continue. And most importantly, Chilean members of the DINA, who was the secret police that Pinochet created immediately after the coup, that was really the agency behind the widespread violation of human rights in Chile. Dozens of these agents received training in Brazilian territory by Brazilian spies, right? And the leadership of DINA also traveled to Brazil, including Manuel Contreras was the head of the DINA. So you had that direct connection. You also had DINA operations that leveraged, that used Brazil, including one operation to hide the deaths of hundreds of members of the Chilean opposition. So it is a multifaceted, I would say, multifaceted support that Brazil provides to those conspiring to destroy the democracy in Chile.
In your book, Roberto, you also show how agents of the Brazilian dictatorship took part in the torture at the Chilean National Stadium shortly after the 1973 military coup. How did that happen?
So 1 month and 3 days after the coup, you have a mission headed by the SNE, the National Information Service of Brazil, with Brazilian intelligence officials to assist Chileans in interrogation sessions, right? And we know what these interrogation sessions in the Estadio Nacional were. They were basically torture sessions right? The Estadio Nacional was really a place where the most despicable acts of human rights violations took place, right? And the Brazilians were assisting Chilean officials who at the time did not have significant experience in torture and extracting information from political opponents, right, of the regime. So Brazil played that role, and in the book I tell a little bit the story of this mission that included, it was headed by the SNE, but also had officials from the army and from the Air Force, not from the Brazilian Navy. And they were really experts on they had expertise on specific groups like the Brazilian Communist Party or certain guerrilla groups that had been almost entirely disbanded in Brazil. But don't forget that at that time, Santiago was when the coup happened, Santiago was the capital of the Brazilian exiled community. You had something like 3,000 to 5,000 Brazilian exiles who went to Chile and organized there. It was a very active community with newspapers. Some of them were working for the Chilean government. Others were working at UN agencies. And you have, you know, from Fernando Henrique Cardoso and Serra to Marco Aurelio Garcia, Emir Sader, you know, many people who'd formed the political establishment in Brazil after the return to democracy in the 1980s, they were in Chile when the coup happened or before that, in the late 60s to early 70s.
The world remembers General Augusto Pinochet as the dictator whose regime tortured, killed and disappeared thousands of people in the name of fighting communism. But many in Chile don't see that period as such a dark chapter in their country's history. Why is that?
Yeah, and if you look at the new polls, you know, one poll was showing that asked, you know, who was responsible for the 1973 coup. Many Chileans, or most Chileans, most know, but a good number of Chileans, something like 30%, would say Allende, even more than the armed forces, right? And much like in Brazil, I would say there is this revisionist movement, right, in Chile, and kind of a rewriting of history of what the Pinochet years meant for the country, right? And if you look at support or a more benign vision of the military dictatorship in Chile, usually it's more prevalent with younger people who'd not lived those years, right? Who think about it in terms of there was a moment where you had safety, you didn't have much corruption and things like that, right? So there is a certain sense of nostalgia, right, in Chile regarding the, you know, the past. And again, I think there are many similarities with kind of the revisiting of the past that we're seeing in Brazil with kind of the post-1964 reality. But what is really important to say is that, you know, this new interpretation is actually a myth, right? When it comes, if you compare from economic performance to, you know, not to mention the human rights situation, if you compare what Chile from 1970 to 1990s to Chile post-redemocratization, actually, when it comes to all kinds of indicators, from poverty levels to access to education, healthcare, etc., Chile made much more progress under democracy than under the military regime, right? One would object to that, saying, yeah, that was only possible because of the radical changes that were implemented during the Pinochet years, namely the reforms that the so-called Chicago Boys implemented, the radical privatization program and, you know, trade liberalization and all that, which is partially true. But at the same time, if you look at what's happening now in Chile, right, the social unrest and the political instability, it's very much a testament to how deficient and problematic that model was, right, in the first place, in the sense that access to healthcare is limited, very limited. Everything is private in Chile. The pension system, which was advertised, you know, was advertised as kind of the solution for emerging countries. Now you have a new generation of people retiring, and they are sometimes receiving pensions that would put them below poverty line. If you're a middle class person in Chile and you want to go to university, there are no public alternatives for you. So you're gonna, you know, get a big loan, and you're gonna enter the labor force, having to pay for a huge debt, and which puts you in a very hard position. So, you know, the deficiencies that we're seeing today are a direct consequence of the radical model that was implemented back then. The answer that many people think is, you know, let's go back to what we had before and have this idyllic version of you know, the past, but it's simply not true. The past was really different. It was one where thousands and thousands of people were tortured and killed, one that also lived with hyperinflation, high unemployment, huge waves of speculation, a privatization process that was permeated by corruption. Now we know that Pinochet enriched many of his friends and family and himself, right? Pinochet, it was found after he left power that he had millions and millions of dollars in offshore accounts across the world, right? In offshore jurisdictions in the United States, in Europe, and all that. So, yeah, it is a revisiting of the past, one that animates the right in Chile and the Pinochetista right, but it's one that it's really based on falsehood, not on real facts.
Now, talking about these polls that you mentioned, they show that only a quarter of Chileans were interested in the 50th anniversary of the coup. And nearly 70% believe that it is an issue that divides the country. How do you see these findings? Because, I mean, acts of violence mar the march honoring victims on Sunday, which is yet another example of how the legacy of the coup and the country's relationship with democracy remains fraught. Let's remember that the 2023 Latino Barometer, which conducts yearly surveys across Latin America, shows that 16% of Chileans believe an authoritarian government could be better than a democratic one. That is low, yes, but it is 4 points higher than 3 years ago. So, big jump.
Yeah. It is worrisome for sure, but it's not a new trend, I would say, for Chile, right? And it actually started several years ago, right, when mainstream political parties started seeing their you know, support erode, right? And when you think about Chile after the transition from the Pinochet years to democracy, first you had the Concertación, which was a center-left coalition that, you know, basically adopted, you know, most of the economic views, not most of the economic views, but it was really a centrist platform when it came to economic policy in terms of fiscal responsibility, very gradual changes in terms of social expenditure. And when that Concertación coalition left power and the center-right came in, they were actually very similar, right? So what it's interesting because after the transition in Chile, you had, let's say, the scope of the debate between the big parties was fairly narrow when it came to economic policy, right? Again, trade liberalization, fiscal policy, monetary policy. There was a very strong consensus in Chile, which, you know, many economists would say that was essential for the accelerated growth that the country saw starting in the 1990s, right? But at the same time, you know, that model was not able to address all the issues that Chileans were facing, right? Inequality, for example, remains extremely high in Chile at levels similar to Peru and Brazil, right? Although Chile is much wealthier than neighboring countries, levels of inequality in Chile are as high or higher than in South America or in Latin America at large. So you started, you know, I remember speaking with a congressman from the center-left party in Chile something like 5 years ago, and he was telling me something that I thought was really interesting, that, you know, after the return of democracy in the 1990s or even in the early 2000s, you would see politicians being invited to TV shows, to, you know, talk shows, and they were real, you know, they were people like them. They were, you know, in the streets, people would go talk to them and treat them well. And by the late 2000, 2010, 14, 15, etc., you could see that the public attitude, right? They were not invited to talk shows anymore. People were not saluting them in the streets. They were not seen as heroes who had, you know, made the country return to democracy and started this age of accelerated growth, but rather of people who were involved sometimes in corruption scandals, were part of, you know, this establishment that was responsible for kind of stagnation or you know, lack of progress in key areas like healthcare, education, security, etc. So you, if you go back to, you know, posters and how they've been measuring public sentiment in Chile, you would see that something like after the second Bachelet government, right, there is a sense that, you know, we need something new, that these political parties are not really making the country grow or solving people's problems, etc., etc. And you get to the point right now where you have a far-right candidate, Kast, who almost won against Boric, right? Boric himself is a person who was not part of this quote-unquote consensus between the center-left and the center-right, right? Boric is a guy who comes, he's much to the left of the Concertación, right? Now he's governing with a coalition of Concertación people, but he came from you know, a more leftist party, Frente Amplio. And at the opposite side, you have, you know, a new party, which is under the leadership of Kast, who's really a far right, similar to Brazilian far right, or, you know, very aligned to Trump in the United States, with that typical drain the swamp type of rhetoric in Chile, right?
Now, Roberto, Trump won, Bolsonaro won, but José Antonio Kast lost in Chile. Still, we are seeing lots of controversy around the Chilean effort to write a new constitution to replace the Pinochet era one. A first draft was rejected for being maybe too much to the left, and a second effort is facing an uphill battle. How do you see this far-right movement brewing in Chile?
Well, they just scored a major victory by controlling the constituent, not constituent, but having the largest base in the they just scored a big victory now by getting the highest number of votes in the assembly responsible for reviewing the new constitution, right? So if you want to say the very conservative of the far right party in Chile has control over the chamber that is ultimately going to be responsible for the constitution, and the constitution is going to be put to a popular vote. And based on the polling that we're seeing, you know, probably the no, right, will win. So Chile would not have a new constitution. It remains to be seen. We still have 2 or 3 months before the vote. But it's unlikely that Chile will have a new constitution anytime soon. Why did Kast lose? I think compared to Brazil, you know, Chile has a degree of institutionality and, you know, the role of memory in Chile when it comes to the crimes of the past is very different from Brazil. But the truth is that Kast almost won, right? It was really by a thin margin. And speaking with people, it remains to be seen. We still have significant time until the elections, but the right is very competitive for the next presidential elections. And the Boric government is having a really hard time governing, not only because of the constitutional crisis, but also because it's been a very convoluted government with internal disputes, a lot of turnaround. Boric, in the middle of the government, decided to reach out again to more establishment figures from the left, who he brought in to help stabilize, one would say, the process a bit. But the truth is that the government is really having a hard time governing in Chile, right? It doesn't have a very good relationship with Congress. And, you know, the constitutional crisis is making things even harder for Boric. And Boric does not have a very high approval rating at the same time. So it is a really, you know, the left is in a very difficult spot right now in Chile. And we see an empowered right that has already, you know, I wouldn't say gained control, but gained the upper hand in the constitutional process and has very good chances of winning the next presidential elections.
Would you say that Chile is going through what happened in Brazil with the far right supplanting the traditional right as the left's strong opponent? Or could we say that the establishment conservative movement is still strong enough?
No, what we're seeing is basically the extreme right under Kast growing by stealing votes from the traditional Piñera, center right. Right. So it's you know, we're seeing kind of the far right, you know, expanding and using again the same rhetoric that we've seen in Brazil, in the United States, and we're seeing in Europe with far right movements, right? When it comes to security, you know, cultural issues, the environment, right? So it's a very typical far right in that sense, and also revisiting the past. But I should also emphasize that even with the far right in Chile, we don't see what we've seen in Brazil with Bolsonaro repeatedly celebrating Ustra and Brazilian tortures, right? Kast proposes like a revisiting of the past, and you know, his family was directly involved with those years, but it's not like he's an outright defender of torture as we've seen in Brazil, right? But this new right is empowered, has weakened the UDI and other kind of, you know, conservative parties that were not radical enough to take down the establishment. I think that's kind of the story for many conservative Chileans. And it's expanding to the detriment of the establishment parties.
Roberto, thanks for being with us this week. Roberto Simon's book is called Brazil Against Democracy, The Dictatorship, The Coup in Chile, and the Cold War in South America. In Spanish, it is titled El Brasil de Pinochet, or Pinochet's Brazil. If you read in Portuguese or Spanish, you will find a link to the book in the show notes. And if you like Explaining Brazil, you should give us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. It takes only a second and it will help us reach a wider audience. Or better yet, subscribe to the Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this podcast. We have a subscription-based business model, and your memberships fuel our journalism and keep us going and growing. Thanks to our subscribers, we have been able to cover Brazil and Latin America extensively, and our work has won or been shortlisted for several international journalism awards. More recently, our newsletters won the Best Newsletter Prize in the Americas from the World Association of Newspapers and News Publishers for a small or local newsroom. And in order to keep doing that work, we need your support. Go to brazilian.report/subscribe. I'm Gustavo Ribeiro. Thanks for listening. Explaining Brazil will be back next week.